Welcome to the Barth Calderon Wealth Protector Podcast. Our founder, Harry Barth, and his son, Brad, are top speakers on asset protection and estate planning to many incredible groups across the country, including the Women Presidents Organization, Vistage, the Young Presidents Organization, the California Apartment Association, and many more. And now, here is your host, Paul Hitchcock.
Hi, this is Paul Hitchcock. Thanks for jumping on Wealth Protector TV. Really excited to have my colleague Brad Barth on the show, who's one of our top asset protection attorneys, and Jason Van Cleef, who is president of Van Cleef Financial Group. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yep. Thank you.
Fantastic. Well, Jason, I'm going to just start with you. So we were talking a little bit offline. You know, both you and Brad are in the asset protection world. Obviously, you're focused on people's investments. So tell us a little bit about your practice, what you're focused on in to the tune of asset protection.
Great. Guys, I appreciate being on. So my focus point for the last 15 years has been wealth management, but really on the ideas of what I've looked at is what the ultra wealthy have done and how they invest. And when it comes to asset protection, you know, obviously Brad and Barth Calderon and you guys are thinking the legal side of it. I think in terms of the wealth side, where, you know, most people are familiar with stocks and bonds and mutual funds and annuities, yet looking at the ultra wealthy, that's not how they invest. And they tend to own tangible types of ideas. They've built their net worth from real estate or businesses or debt, things of that nature, things that tend to not be part of the public markets, things that are focused on cash flow versus growth and appreciation. And by doing so and building these portfolios for my clients, seeing a year like 2008, you know, in terms of my version of asset protection, we didn't really see anyone getting clobbered. We didn't see the stock market losses because we weren't part of the stock market. The types of real estates we focus on, things of that nature, whether it's apartment buildings or long-term care or storage, stuff, but using assets that we believe, you know, my impression is common sense. I think Voltaire said it best, common sense ain't so common. And, you know, when you see people in the stock market doing the same thing again and again and again, 2007, 1994, 1997, I mean, you look at even so much as last year in 2018, where we had the third quarter where the market was down 22%. My version of peace of mind is what I think of asset protection. You know, on Thanksgiving, I wrote my clients a letter stating, just enjoy your holiday feasts or whatever you're going to do this holidays. Why? Because you haven't lost a dime in the stock market because we're not part of it. And then on Christmas Eve, when the stock market was down 670 some points, worst Christmas Eve going back in stock market history, I wrote another email out to my clients saying, again, enjoy yourselves. You know, don't worry about the holiday presents you're going to be doing stuff because again, you're not down 22%. That is one of the benefits of owning these other types of categories. So beyond that, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you, Jason. It's very interesting. So I've often heard that with the ultra high net worth, that the risk that they take outside of maybe running their business or whatever they're doing is intentional risk. Like they want to understand the risk they have or not have. And so do you find that when you first start engaging with them that they're very aware of risk, or is it part of an educational process you need to take them through?
You know, I incidentally, the first thing I start off with any new potential client is we talk about risk. And I actually state very bluntly, the only guarantee in finance is something will go wrong. That is the only guarantee. And so my last book I wrote in 2013 talks about the idea of a financial table, and I want 30 legs on a financial table that are all independent of each other. All legs, whether it's different categories, different concepts, things of that, working together with the guarantee that a leg or two will break, distributions might be cut, things that will not go well in certain ideas. That being said, if I got 30 legs and two legs break, I usually have two or three legs that do exceptionally well, and then I have a whole bunch in the middle hitting singles and doubles. And that is what allowed us to ride through 2008 extremely unscathed, with more importantly, kind of this kind of peace of mind concept. So yes, using when business owners and definitely people that built their net worth from real estate, they get risk. They get that nothing's perfect. But going in with that attitude, for instance, I I will meet clients, and I actually, when I talk about this, if a client says, well, I can't have any risk, I said, well, then you're not going to be working with me, and I can't work with you, likewise,
right.
Because that is not realistic. Right. You know, like Brad and what you guys profess with the asset protections, nothing's perfect, but you can put as enough safety bumpers as possible in place that if something bad does go wrong, you're going to bump along, at least stay the course. And that's kind of the major thing that we're focused on.
So Jason, I have a question, and you talked about real estate, and you're right. A lot of our high net worth clients have real estate as part of their portfolio. But most times they actually own dirt. They have commercial buildings, they have single family homes, they have condominiums, they have apartment buildings. So those make us as asset protection lawyers very nervous, because the client themselves is the landlord. And to your point, we try to create all types of structures to insulate them. I was just talking to a client yesterday, and she was saying, well, I'm going to get involved in this syndicate thing. And my question I was asking her is, what are you buying into? Are you buying a piece of dirt, or are you buying an LLC membership interest? Are you buying like a REIT? Are you buying a tick? What is it that you're buying? So when you're talking about your real estate portfolio and your 30-leg approach, what is it that the clients are getting when they invest with you?
Typically, it's a little bit of everything, but in general, it's partnerships that are LLC memberships, you know, having the inherent asset protection that comes in with that.
Right.
And then obviously layering that with, you know, and something that you guys have taught me, and I've obviously done for myself with you guys, is taking those investments, which are sheltered in themselves, putting them inside of bigger shelters, and inside of bigger shelters on top of that.
Right.
So it's just, it's multiple layers to create a defense.
Okay, so when clients are investing with you, it's they're buying slivers of pre-existing entities, partnership interest,
LLC
interest. Okay, that's great.
Correct.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get out when I spoke with her. I was like, what is it you're buying? She didn't even know. So I said, you got to go back and find out, because where do we come in? It is all dependent upon what it is that you're acquiring. And you're right, we do have business holding entities, like you said, if they do get the limited partnership or the LLC interest, they have inherent protection at that level. So we're not so much concerned about liabilities trickling down, but we are concerned about protecting the source of income that comes out of there. So we do have a different level of layering on that business approach. But that it's good to know, because I would much rather my clients get involved in partnership interests than going out there and getting the dirt. But to that extent, what's some of the advantages and disadvantages of owning a partnership interest as opposed to the dirt? I mean, aren't there rents and capital gain benefits and tax deductions? Does that flow through similarly, just at a proportionate interest in your investment structures?
Yeah, so one of the perks of, if someone is doing after-tax investments in trusts or ownerships and so forth, not retirement accounts, all the same perks of owning the individual piece is passed through the partnership. Mm-hmm. In fact, our partnerships, because you're getting into bigger, stronger, more financially backed groups, they're doing things like cost segregation studies, which is dramatically pushing forward the depreciation schedule. So for the most part, a lot of the income is free. And it's tax deferred, your cost basis is getting lowered. But in terms of time value of money, being able to have all your income today and then pay the taxes 5 or 6 or 7 years down the road is an advantage. And so working with these structures, and now granted, we'll do things with 1031 exchanges heavily. Obviously other parts of my practice are income tax reduction, with a lot of different other things like that. But yeah, in terms of these partnerships, the major difference of owning it outright is control. So if you're in one of our partnerships, it's not ours. I am a glorified middle guy.
Right.
I believe that there's better people than me in all categories. So
right.
My goal I've always described is I'm trying to build an Olympic basketball team for a client. I will go find the best in self-storage, the best in long-term care, the best in collateralized debt, equipment, cell phone towers, whatever. And give all these superstars a little sliver of the puzzle and let them all work together, knowing that if one leg breaks on the basketball team, mm-hmm. no big deal, because you got the other superstars playing. Mm-hmm. But yes, in terms of cash flow, individual ownership, you're dealing with the terrible T's, tenants, toilets, trash, headaches, teenagers, termites, you name it.
That's right.
In the partnerships, that's being dealt with it. But there's perks for both. You know, when we have clients that we will do portfolios of single family houses, for instance, where we will still have them managed and wrapped up into a program, but they own the partnership in its entirety, but it's still given protections.
All right, so correct me if I'm wrong. I'm thinking of this as a mutual fund of real estate portfolios.
Real estate and multiple other categories. It's oil and gas. It's equipment, which is cell phone towers. It can be private equity. People have been very hot to trot on the cannabis space. So I went and searched for a couple of years, and we ended up finding a group that, you know, a gentleman running it is one of the best of class, private equity guy for 30 years. And we said, okay, we believe he's a superstar at what he's going to do in this space. So we found him and the group, and for the clients that it's right for their particular portfolios, they can have exposure in that space. Right. But then again, they're not the ones trying to do it. We're not right. trying to go do that stuff.
And so your role then with the client is finding out which is the proper sliver for their risk tolerance.
Correct. And so it's a combination. We're working as high level wealth management, but when it comes to the portfolio side, yeah. You know, a client comes in, I have my $3 million, whatever it might be, $2 million, $1 million, whatever. And we'll break it up into lots of legs, because really what we're trying to do is generate a cash flow in the 6 to 8% kind of range. Mm-hmm. And then if there's growth on top of that, great. One of my aces in the hole is with tangible investments, you have inherent inflation built in. You know, the US government is the biggest debtor in the world, and they want inflation to erode their debt. So they will push money into the system, you know, with the Fed printing money, quantitative easing. That gives us a buffer zone. But at least, you know, if we're talking a hypothetical return for a client, let's say, I know everyone says 10%, the stock market's goal is to get 2% in dividends and 8% in growth. Well, you know, if you don't get the growth, you've only made 20% of your goal. We flip the equation, and I'm trying to get 6 to 8% in cash flow. That means I only need a little bit for growth to hit the goal. And what I like to talk to clients about is if the growth doesn't happen, say another massive recession hits, mm-hmm. at least we got 70, 80% of our target already hit just from the distributions.
What about the tax advantages? How does that play in? That goes back to my question before about owning the dirt itself. There's typically tax benefits.
So every tax benefit you have as an individual is passed through as a partnership level. So it's unless, of course, we have a lot of clients that do these with their retirement accounts, and obviously that we're not worried about taxes in that case. We're just looking for the total return.
Oh, really? So yes, this is a good place for self-directed IRAs.
Correct. Oh. In fact, about 70% of my business is pensions with engineers from Raytheon, for instance, who were looking for many of these concepts that they don't want the liquidity, especially in a retirement account. You don't need liquidity. Mm-hmm. You want distributions.
Right.
And so, no, these work great. You just don't get the perks in that case.
Right.
Yeah. And so, Brad, this a question that kind of parlays over to you is when you're dealing with the high net worth folks and they have these sort of investments, what's the asset protection discussion you got to have when you and Jason are working together?
Right. So, yeah. So as I mentioned a little bit earlier, it's one of the, we look to compile things together. So if Jason is working with a client and they wind up getting the 30 slivers, let's just say the 30 legs of the portfolio, we want to bundle those together because those are all different sources of income. And many times if you're buying limited partnership interests, or maybe you have economic interests on LLCs, you may not be able to control whether or not there's a distribution that's coming out. It's coming out from the LLC manager. It's coming out from the general partner. So there's money that's flowing that you really have no control over. As opposed to if it's your LLC where you're the member and you're the manager, you can control when those distributions arise. And so from an asset protection perspective, what we're worried about is a creditor coming over and standing in your shoes as the economic beneficiary. And so if you can control when a distribution comes out, if ever, then a creditor who has a remedy against you, who got this what's called a charging order over the entity, they may never collect because there's no money being passed through because you control whether that distribution ever arises. So that is one of the inherent benefits of charging order protections that arise inside limited partnerships and also in LLCs. But if you don't control that event, no, your oil and gas, a general partner is distributing it. maybe under some of Jason's portfolios, a manager is distributing. You have no control. So what we're looking to do is to protect the income that's flowing out of these various interests. So that goes to the layering. So we wind up taking all of Jason's investments, I call this the fractional business interests, and we put a wrapper around that. Not so much from a liability point of view, because the liability is already inherently protected in Jason's portfolios. It's already held in these limited liability entities. But I want to control the cash flow. I want to protect that cash flow so the creditor doesn't sit in with the receiver, and as those managers that you can't control make a distribution, they're just sitting here and saying, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. So we want to insulate that cash flow. That's kind of our, that's our piece to insulate that cash flow. That's how we would fit. That's how we would fit into Jason's model.
And if somebody's getting sued, Brad, you know, Jason's dealing with these kind of, you know, maybe classifying most of them as alternative investments and different things. Creditors, you know, even though it's not an easy stocks, bonds, and cash, they have no problem going after these type of investments too.
Yeah, because they'll take anything. I mean, a creditor. I mean, if you are a creditor and someone owes you money, Paul, are you going to say, I'm not going to take the gold, I only want the cash?
It's like, no.
If it's green, I'm taking it. I don't care. No, there may be a cost in its liquidation, but they're still going to take it.
So they're still attractive assets.
Absolutely. Certainly. Now, I compare that to somebody running a car wash, right? Okay, now if somebody has to step in the shoes of a going concern, and I don't really want to run a car wash, right? It's different. That requires active engagement to maintain a going concern for its ability to produce a cash flow to pay off that debt. But here it's passive, and it doesn't really matter what it is. It's attractive to a potential creditor. Yeah.
Jason, when you're talking to people, does the asset protection element from a legal standpoint come into your kind of onboarding discussions?
It comes in because I bring it up. You know, I describe people's wealth as like a bucket of wealth, and you know, no matter how much I can improve going into the top of the bucket through cash flow distributions, returns, things like that, if they have all these leaks in the bottom sucking it out, poor estate planning, poor income tax planning, you name it, what's the point? I mean, you know, a good example, you know, you could be doing all this great stuff and they get sued and lose everything. Well, yay, I'm glad I did a great return for them, because now I did it for the opposing attorneys and the people that sued them. Mm-hmm. So I bring it up, and I see this all the time where people, you know, they don't have their basics of living trust. But then when, you know, upper high net worth, especially business owners, things of that nature, again, you know, a good example of this is my highest net worth clients. No matter how much I try to beat her on the head in terms of talking about this, she has, you know, $40 million of real estate in terms of her personal name. It just drives me crazy. So yes, I do bring it up, and this is where then, you know, I work with Brad and you guys to kind of help these folks work together.
So knowing that you're able to pool money, what would be some of the just a two-part question. One, what would be a minimum amount that someone would need to work with the Van Cleef Investments, right? What would be the minimum so I could hire Jason to get me involved in this?
Yeah, so most of the investments we deal with, it's a funny you ask that question, because I've always had a rule from day one, no net worth minimum, because I can't tell you how many stories that have gone in the past where someone walked in my door. You know, I'll just give you a good example. A lady in 2005, you know, she had $4,000. I put half of it in euros and half in gold, and I kept it liquid because she couldn't tie up her money, and knowing what was going to happen with inflation, she actually did very well during those both. But I then taught her about real estate, and then I sent her on her way, and I spent probably 20, 25 hours with her. Well, 5 years later, it was 2010, her uncle came in, who had a $20 million portfolio at Sanford Bernstein, and moved it all to me, saying, I've never had an advisor work with me that much as you've worked with my niece. So the point is, I've always had this rule. That being said, most investments have minimums of $5,000, $25,000, or $50,000. There is something called an accreditation standard, which is a lot of the tools in my tool chest are fully accredited, which means you have to have $1 million of investable net worth, not counting the equity in your private home. A lot of tools are state accredited, which is a $250,000 net worth. So generally, it's between that $250 million. Frankly, most of my clients have over the million investable net worth because they're looking for all the tools in the tool chest, so forth.
And once you get these accounts set up, these portfolios, how often are they being looked at? Is it quarterly? Is it annually? I mean, as far as you, as far as mixing up different investments?
Yeah, the beauty of kind of this approach is it actually, once, you know, for instance, if I found a storage facility and I say, this, Brad, for you, I think would be a good portion for 3% of your capital. Mm-hmm. Let's let them run. Well, it's a 5 to 7 year investment. Yeah. And so when we sit down, typically I do 6 month reviews with most of my clients because frankly, there's not a lot to do. That's the beauty of it. Mm-hmm. I will tell you, during the fourth quarter of last year, when the market was getting clobbered, my phone never rang. And that is, to me, a testimony to the idea of the stability of having categories that are not part of the active public markets. Mm-hmm. So typically it's every 6 months. Do I have clients that come in every month? Absolutely. I have clients. Yeah, I have a gentleman that came in every Thursday morning for years and he wanted to talk about his stuff. And granted, you know, he's very respectful of my time. He wasn't talking about his cats or anything. But that being said, it's totally dependent on the client when they want to come in. I wish more of my clients would come in more often, actually.
Yeah. So with someone, so do you have the type of investment where it's okay, Jason, this is my percent, my pie. This is my percentage of stuff. I'm just going to send you $10,000 every month or every other month. Just add it to my portfolio, or is it, or you have to keep on buying more units? How does it work? I just say here.
Yeah, that generally. So in general, we don't have the clients that are dripping in. It's generally the 50 to 65 year old retiree who has saved, who's, you know, a lot of times it's with selling a property that will 1031 exchange into the securitized 1031 space. Generally people that have their pensions are retiring from something, 401ks or whatever, mm-hmm. or just after tax. You know, we've seen lately a lot of inheritees where they've got some money from mom and dad and they're looking for ideas and they're referred to us. So, and that generally, I mean, in general, 250 to 500,000 is what builds a very diverse table day one. Right. If a client comes in, say, you know, and I'm not all about grabbing all the money. In fact, I tell clients, I'd rather, if you have whatever dollars, I'd rather build in slowly with you. Let's do three or four ideas, maybe 25,000 a piece. See how they work. See the cash flow. Let's work on a tax year. Let's see the K-1s mm-hmm. and get used to it and then build in. I'd much rather establish a relationship for the long run than try to be a one-hit wonder.
So for clients that do have let's say they do want a diversified portfolio and they want real estate to be a particular sector, what would be a reasonable percentage? Okay, I know it's going to be all over the board based upon the client's overall risk factors, but what do you see on a regular basis as far as your real estate? Would it be 30%? Would it be 20%? How would it fit into a person who has more diversification than just real estate?
So depending on the person, but if, let's say I'm managing someone's entire portfolio, let's say it's $1 million, let's just keep the math simple. Okay. Real estate will tend to be 30 to 35% of that category. Mm-hmm. I'll have money management being about 30%, and then the other 35-40% will be different categories. But real estate is generally the biggest category alongside the equity side. I need equity because I need stocks and bonds because I need liquidity for a client. You never want to siphon away all their ability to access. But for the most part, depending on the people, you know, we'll have 60-65% in alternate investments and 35 will be in real estate. But the real estate is divvied up into storage centers, long-term care, apartments, your single tenant big business, broken apart, what have you, things that are very recession resistant. So you're in multiple types of real estate, single family houses as an example.
Okay, great. So working with you then, you're more than just the real estate there. You can do the full 100 degree or 360 degree pie. You can handle the 30 to 36% real estate. And then the other, what would that be, percentage of equities, and you can still do those more traditional type of investments.
Correct. Right? Yeah, it's a balance. And again, liquidity is stocks and bonds. You need liquidity. The problem with liquidity is uncertainty and volatility. So we tend to mitigate that amount. And then on top of that, we focus heavily on income tax reduction. I mean, that is something that's a massive leak for people, especially business owners and real estate owners. They have no idea the taxes they're paying because, frankly, they go to their CPA, and that CPAs are important. Their job is to figure out your mess. It's not to reduce it. So that's the other thing that then we work on heavily.
So you talked about using self-directed IRAs. You talked about people that are just in the, maybe in the wealth building or maybe in more in the retirement areas. How would you work with like other professionals? I'm thinking about myself now. Like I'm a professional trustee for a lot of my clients. And so somebody passes away. I wind up getting $5 million and being held in trust for them. I have a fiduciary duty to make sure that that trust portfolio is protected. It's also being productive for them. We have some limitations based upon the Prudent Investor Act here under California and also some principal and income standards that we have to work with. So do you have experience in working with trustees as making this real estate investments part of their portfolio?
Yes. In fact, those are the portfolios that we tend to work very well with because typically the beneficiaries are looking for cash flow. The trustee does not want to disperse the capital, the principal out. They want to say, here's, $10,000 a month of income. Well, how are you going to generate that $10,000 a month of income? And what we tend to do is we're able to generate because, the cash flows on illiquid investments tend to be in that 5-9% range. So it gives us a much bigger bump. Plus the tax savings because the trust, are taxed at the highest level.
That's crazy.
Having most of the income sheltered via the K-1s and so forth is a win. If I can get an 8% cash flow over someone and they're only, on $100,000, they're getting $8,000 and they're only reporting $1,000 on the K-1, it's a huge win for them in terms of bottom line.
Yeah, well, that's great. That's great to know. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah, I think it's great information. I see so much synergy between the two practices, even just, Jason, when you mentioned your clients getting an inheritance. I know, Brad, you're all over how to receive that, the proper way to do it. And Jason, I'm sure you're having high-level discussions with the kids about how not to lose the inheritance for mom and dad.
I'll tell you, there's one actually added benefit of the illiquid investments as being, and I speak to my clients all the time. I think the rule, it used to be 90-90-90, which was 90% of beneficiaries spend 90% of their inheritance in the first 90 days. And that rule is actually...
That's why you got to hire a professional.
And then now it's gone up to 90-90-60. So the beneficiaries are blowing all the money in 60 days. Right. So something about having a portfolio of illiquid investments that are generating significant cash flow, the beneficiaries, when inherently they show up saying, I want to take all the money out, you can say, sorry, you can't. There's no way to sell this particular investment. But guess what? You're going to have a check for $15,000 this month. And then next month, yep, and the month after that. And the nice part about that is they learn to appreciate the cash flow without blowing the principal. And so it's kind of a forced, a forced discipline, yep, in the beginning. And eventually when these things come out, what we find is the beneficiaries have learned to love cash flow, mm-hmm, and they let the principal work.
Now, do you also work with more principal growth portfolios also? Because we have both. We have both income beneficiaries and we have beneficiaries that don't need the income because maybe they're already independently wealthy, but they are looking more for principal growth for the next generation. Right. So as you can imagine, you have a family, maybe mom and dad pass away and there's four kids. So I got four different beneficiaries that have four different financial needs. And so when I break their assets down, their inheritance down into four separate shares, again, one may have maybe they're a teacher and they have a much higher need for income, whereas on the other end of the spectrum, again, could be that independently wealthy doctor who doesn't need it, but they're more concerned about growth. So are you able to, so you just mentioned that you're able to produce income, which is fantastic. And I absolutely can second everything you said about beneficiaries blowing their money. But what about principal growth assets?
So everything we have, it's income plus a growth. I mean, if I have a long-term care facility, which is spitting out, let's say 7%, our target on that one probably will be a 12 to 15% return. So there will be a growth component. Definitely with clients that are more growth oriented, we have many, many tools that are focused on growth without even any cash flow. Mm-hmm. Real estate developments, for instance, is a good example of this. We have right now example storage facility group that there's no cash flow, but they're targeting a high teen IRR for the clients. Mm-hmm. In general though, the way I like to explain it to clients is, it's basically works out to the same thing. Total return. What are we trying to make?
Right.
Whether if our goal is 10% a year, hypothetical, whether I get it from the cash flow and a little bit of growth or big growth, little cash flow, still want to try to hit the target.
Right.
And what I find is when we can create a cash flow spiral, that is well above what someone needs, well, then the rest of the income can be plowed back to principal that can keep going. So ultimately, we're achieving the goal, which is hitting whatever that target is.
Great. And then again, one last question back on my fiduciary duty stuff. What type of reporting is provided to the clients? Are getting quarterly statements, monthly? How is it showing back when for the clients?
Yeah, so every group we have has either quarterly or monthly statements. Mm-hmm. Plus, we do a semi-annual summary that my firm puts together for the clients. It's more, you know, that semi-annual is about us giving either the fiduciary or the investors updates on every single program. I like to go through every idea to reiterate why we're doing what we're doing. But basically, every group we work with either has online portals, access to all the due diligence. I mean, they work basically like stocks. I mean, most of them have the same reporting. They're just not doing it publicly.
Yeah. Great. Great. Fantastic. Thanks, Jason. Great.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Great information, Jason, Brad. Thank you so much. Excellent. And we'll see you next time.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Barth Calderon Wealth Protector Podcast. Thanks for listening.